This is January 24th, 2010. Most of you who are here in the Zendo know that this is an unusual schedule this morning on a Teisho Sunday. But for people who are hearing this as a recording, let me just say what's going to happen today. I'm going to give a Teisho that is shorter than usual, that will be about Haiti and compassion and giving and other related things. And then after that, we'll have the ceremony of aid and disaster relief ceremony. And I'll say a little bit more about that later. So I need to keep this fairly short because the ceremony is longer than our usual Sunday chanting service. And we don't want to keep people here too late. I don't think I need to spend time talking about what a horrendous, unspeakable disaster has come in the wake of the earthquake in Haiti that happened, I don't know, a couple weeks ago or so. How do we respond to this? I thought I would just explore the sort of the dynamics that go on internally in, I would guess, many people, myself for one, and just reflect on what it means to act responsibly in the wake of mass human suffering. I see a response as having two components. There's the feeling response, and then there's the action response. And response is an important word in Zen. You might say that in any situation, what is our responsibility? Or let's make it individual. In any situation, what is my responsibility, my moral responsibility as an individual? And I think the only blanket statement we can make is our responsibility is to respond. And then after that, it's up to the individual to know what that means. But the response starts with a feeling of sympathy, maybe self-evident, but let's just examine that. There are people, maybe many people, who when hearing about and seeing the images of a catastrophe such as happened in Haiti, who don't feel sympathy. Why would we not feel sympathy? It's ridiculous to talk on the level of shoulds and oughts. You know, well, you should feel sympathy. My God, look at all that suffering. There's something wrong with you. That has no business in Zen. Because the truth is that each one of us has this human sympathy. This is where faith comes in. Even with those who might find ways to avoid feeling sympathy, there is what enlightenment reveals is that somewhere down deep there is, in that beating heart, there is the capacity for a sympathetic response. So that's the premise. We start from that. Okay, that there is no one who is so robotic in her or his true nature. There's no one who is a machine. That we all have the capacity to respond. So why would we? I mean, we all have the capacity to feel. So why would an individual not feel sympathy for for what's happening. There are different reasons that I came up with as I was sitting this morning and reflecting on all this. The grossest is having this notion in the mind that their suffering is punishment for punishment by God. Let's say their suffering is punishment for their sins. This is almost not even worth mentioning, except that a leading cleric in I think Lutheran cleric, I can't remember which of those guys it was, who after the Katrina disaster came out and said that this was punishment by God for all the immorality in New Orleans, all of the everything that happens there. But there are those who would come up with this. I would hope there aren't too many thousands or millions, but it's been said. So that's one reason that one way that people cannot feel sympathy. They're just getting what they deserve, and if they had behaved themselves, then this wouldn't be happening to them. All right. So much for that one. Another way that feeling sympathy is blocked is just denial. Denial is a major defense mechanism in psychology. And it's just denying that it's really as bad as is shown. You know, we talk about the denial of the Holocaust. That's if you can deny the Holocaust, you can deny anything. And there are those who can just sort of block it out, or consciously. Not denial is an unconscious defense mechanism. But even consciously block it out of a kind of a revulsion or a fear of what it all really means. There are people who just can't stand to see suffering. They just turn away and stiff arm it because it's too painful, and they somehow can armor themselves so they don't have to feel the anguish that comes would naturally come from seeing that. But I think the maybe the single most common mechanism behind not feeling. Not having a natural human response of sympathy to something like that is our habit that we all share to one degree or another, our habit of distancing by our thoughts. That is, if we can see the Haitians or other people who are suffering greatly, if we can see them as just them, there's us and there's them, that them out there, that remote, abstract them, then we're not going to feel it the same. And this is the, I think, the primary problem is to overcome this sense of division or of separateness. You know, I think the closest thing we have in Zen to sin, we don't use the word sin, but the closest thing we have is, I would submit, is separation. When we buy into the illusion of a them or a you as a separate from us and me, then we're not going to feel sympathy for others' pain and suffering. And this is also the most, the deepest, most ingrained source of non-feeling is our making others into an abstraction. And this is the fundamental problem in Zen. It's not a conscious thing now. The other things I mentioned were consciously thinking, well, they got what they deserve because they're immoral, or other conscious things we might rationalizations for not feeling. This is not conscious. This is something that is so insidious because it's not a discrete thought. We're not thinking about it. We're just distanced from it because of this film of conceptualization. And this is also the single biggest obstacle in Zen practice generally. It's not having a thought about lunch or a thought about what that person did or other discrete thoughts. Those are hard enough, dealing with those thoughts as they float into our awareness. What is really a challenge is this haze of abstraction that we're not aware of. And this is what becomes more and more, what is revealed more and more through long practice, is we start to discover that there is so much of this haze of conceptualizing that goes on all the time that we're not even aware of. And this is the main obstacle, I think, to really feeling, having a real sympathetic response to suffering, whether it's millions of people or it's an individual we encounter in the street or somewhere else. This thought activity that's below our awareness that that hardens our heart, that seals off this natural feeling of sympathy. So ultimately, it's a matter of doing daily zazen for long years that will hydrate that dried up coating around our heart, or thaw, melt the coldness that can set in through this. Zen Master Dogen, one of the two greatest lights of Japanese Zen, was once asked, "What is the purpose of Zen practice?" And he said, "To develop a tender heart." Now there is a danger of getting stuck in the feeling. There's a certain type of person who is very, very willing, maybe a little too willing to read about human tragedy and feel it, but they somehow get stuck in the feeling, and it's almost like they're aware. Oh, I'm feeling this so deeply. I'm a very feeling, sensitive, sympathetic person, but they don't go the next step. They I would say they cling to the feeling, and it's sort of like unconsciously they're thinking, okay, this is quite a wonderful human response I'm having, and certainly it's better than feeling nothing, reading or seeing images about terrible suffering and just being so armored that you don't feel anything. But that's something, I think that some people should be aware of is not clinging to the feeling and moving on from there. There's this very interesting development that happens through long Zen practice, which is you do tend to feel things more as the sealant of thoughts and conceptualization becomes dissolved. As it dissolves, you feel things more, and sometimes it can be quite it can be alarming how deeply you come to feel other people's pain. But there is a parallel development that balances that out, and that is the sense of detachment. Now, detachment can be misunderstood as distancing. I'm not talking about intellectualizing about human suffering and finding distance from it that way. Detachment is something that can go hand in hand with feeling, but it's a balancing of, instead of just pure anguish, this is horrible, this life of suffering, I feel everyone's suffering and my own, it's just, I feel like I have no skin. That's what people sometimes report after they've been doing practice for a while. But what I say to them is that if you're doing Zazen on a daily basis, if you do it long enough, then that hypersensitivity will be balanced by a greater sense of detachment. What's the detachment? The detachment is recognizing that, well, first of all, that pain is a condition of life. It's inescapable. It's the nature of sentient life is pain. There's a story of the Buddha and the mustard seed, where a young woman, young mother, who just lost her child, went to the Buddha in anguish and said, "Can you help me? Can you help me?" with her dead baby in her arms. And the Buddha, we're told, did not start sobbing. I would assume that he felt moved by her anguish, but he was able to say to her in a clear, balanced way, he said, "This is what I want you to do. Go through the village, this is 2,500 years ago, go through the village and at every house ask if there has been a death in the family, in that household, and collect a mustard seed." I guess mustard seeds are extremely small, like poppy seeds. "Collect a mustard seed from every house in which there's been no death." And the woman bowed and said, "All right." So off she went with her dead baby still in her arms from house to house. And she came back with, of course, no mustard seeds, because in every house there had been a death, at least one death. It's moving. Detachment comes from moving beyond the personal and understanding, seeing the big picture, recognizing that there is this law of karma. Now, let's be clear. Karma has nothing to do with punishment by a god or any kind of agent for sin. Karma is just a natural law of the universe, that when we act or speak or think in violation of the natural order of things, the natural law of things, when we are out of harmony with the Tao, then there will be a resultant reaction. When we act when we hurt people or ourselves, each one of us is a person, when we hurt people, then we will be hurt. We will suffer up the road at some point. this is the cornerstone of Buddhist philosophy. But I think when people find fault with karma, let's say a child suffers, and they might say, "Well, what has that child ever done to deserve such suffering? Innocent child." Well, if your perspective is limited to a single lifetime, well, you got a good argument. What has that child ever done in this lifetime? But this is where we get into rebirth, which might be too much for some people, but there it is. This is not the only time we have lived. There have been millions, according to the Buddha and the great enlightened masters. So we have lived before millions of times, and we have done all kinds of horrendous things. And it is only a matter of time before that karma ripens and we have to reap what we have sown. But now what the mistake people make when they hear that, some people think, "Oh, how that's so cold and awful to think that a child could have sown that karma." The problem is that they imagine that you're standing back with your arms folded and saying, "Well, I guess, you know, let's go to the Haitians. It's their karma. What are you going to do? You know, that's something that somehow every one of them has generated in the past, has sown that karma, and this is, you know, they're expiating their karma." No. No, 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 no. That is not what we're talking about here. That kind of distancing and cold logic, because the second part of response, after the feeling, comes the action. And here, again, I bring in the element of faith, that it is our nature to respond, to help, to actively respond. And if we're not actively responding, then we're going against our nature. Our nature is being blocked. And that's what we want to try to, of course, always live in harmony with our true nature and do what we can to come into line with our true nature, which means responding actively to suffering. And that will not come out of any intellectualizing about the person's karma. That the word karma has to even enter into one's response. I recently came across an article in the New York Times by Nicholas Kristof, who seems to be some kind of a living bodhisattva of kinds. He's devoted years of columns in the New York Times to broadcasting the terrible crimes and suffering in various parts of the world. And this article is called "Our Basic Human Pleasures: Food, Sex, and Giving." I won't read much of the article, just the last column where he says, "I see this..." Oh, wait. Brain scans by neuroscientists confirm that altruism carries its own rewards. A team including Dr. Jorge Moll of the NIH, National Institute of Health, found that when a research subject was encouraged to think of giving money to a charity, parts of the brain lit up that are normally associated with selfish pleasures like eating or sex. The implication is that we are hardwired to be altruistic. To put it another way, it's difficult for humans to be truly selfless, for generosity feels so good. And then he quotes this a Brian Mulaney, of co-founder of Smile Train, which helps tens of thousands of children each year who are born with cleft lips and cleft palates. This guy says, the most selfish thing you can do is to help other people. Mr. Mulaney was a successful advertising executive, driving a Porsche and taking dates to the Four Seasons, when he felt something was missing and began volunteering for good causes. He ended up leaving the business world to help kids smile again, and all that makes him smile too. And then the article ends, so at a time of vast needs, from Haiti to our own cities, there's a nice opportunity for symbiosis. So many afflicted people, and so much benefit to us if we try to help them. Let's remember that while charity has a mixed record helping others, it has an almost perfect record of helping ourselves. Helping others may be as primal a human pleasure as food or sex. Well, this is an appeal to people who want to get something out of it. But, all right, fair enough. It's not like the victims of the earthquake in Haiti are going to take the time to question our motives, you know. Well, you know, is this just white guilt or whatever, you know. It doesn't matter. Does it matter? Well, you know, in the purest sense, it matters in terms of our own karma, I guess, if you will. But those who get snarled up in those thoughts can find us another reason not to give. Well, it's not absolutely pure. Maybe this is kind of, I'm getting some pleasure from this. And maybe I won't do, you know. Don't go there. I collect articles now and then of other people who just are such embodiments of the spirit of the Bodhisattva, of Kanon. Here's one, a forklift driver who has given away $1 million in donations. 78-year-old forklift driver at Ford Motor Company, who has spent a lifetime soaking up as much overtime as possible and pulling down around $100,000 a year just so he can give most of it away. There's another article here about an untouchable, a member of the untouchable caste in India, who gave $20 million to his native village in India. There's so many cases like this. But ultimately, what we want to do is bring out our natural, we want to bring out our own nature, which includes the response of the Bodhisattva of compassion. Kanon or Avalokiteshvara, given it's her or his original name, Avalokiteshvara means she who hearkens to the cries of the world. Or other translations are one who regards or responds to the cries of the world. And this is our nature, so much so that it really doesn't need to involve any conscious working of the mind. It's beyond consciousness in a way. We hear these stories of people in emergencies who just fly into action, and very often, the ones I've read, very often later when they're interviewed and made into a hero, they're just stunned. There are days, and the person, the interviewer might say, "What were you thinking? Were you doing thinking this?" And they say, "I don't know." They can't account for jumping into the Potomac River to save people who went down in a plane. This is a long time ago, but it really sticks in my mind. They say, I was just walking along, and next thing I knew, I was in the water. It isn't thought through. It isn't thought that this would be a good thing to do. I'd be a good person if I did this. No, there's just response. The just on Christmas Day, the the guy who was trying to light his underwear on bomb in his underwear, and then there was this guy who they were interviewing, another passenger who the other passenger said just like that responded. So it's beyond conscious thought, beyond intellection. Certainly, it's beyond notions of right and wrong, good and bad. But I would say it's even beyond feeling. These people, they don't have time to get bogged down in feelings. Ultimately, I would suggest it's not necessary to go to some place of misery and try to dredge up a response. It's a physical response. There is just this native instinct in us where we just can respond as called for. There's a koan that I read in Taisho not that long ago in the Blue Cliff Record. The title is "The Hands and Eyes of the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion." In some representations of this bodhisattva of compassion, there are many arms or hands and eyes, and the idea is that first there's the apprehending of the suffering, seeing it or hearing it, and then the second is the reaching out to help those. So here is the question: one Chinese master asks another, "What use does the great bodhisattva of compassion make of all those hands and eyes?" And the second master said, "It is like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow with outstretched hand in the middle of the night." It is like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow with outstretched hand in the middle of the night. Where is the thinking? Where is the moral measuring of what's right to do? Where is even the feeling? Feeling is a wonderful thing. You know, in Zen, I said at the workshop yesterday, in Zen we learn to do less talking and thinking and more feeling and acting. But even feeling is not the floor of the mind. It's not the ground. We can go beyond feeling to this place in our heart where there is just this immediate response. Let me talk about the ceremony just a little bit. Many of you have done this ceremony on one occasion or another before. Some of you not. It's a way for us to respond physically, and physically includes with a voice, respond to suffering and to honor a need that we feel to do something. Chanting itself is a way to embody this compassionate heart that we all have in common. However buried it may be, there it is. And chanting, especially chanting the Kanongyo, that's the Bodhisattva of Compassion, chanting that, chanting the Shosaimyo, that's the shorter of the two Dharani, which we do in, chant in Japanese. This is the Dharani for averting disaster. These are the two main ones that we do in disaster relief ceremonies. Doing this, just getting, vocalizing these chants is a way to respond to suffering. And also lighting incense. Each person will have a chance in the circumambulation through the Zendo to offer powdered incense. And then there's also the chance people have to make a monetary offering in a little envelope. In case anyone doesn't know this, you haven't heard it already, the envelopes are out in the link, the entrance building, if you didn't see them or whatever. And if during Kinhin, you could go out there and get one. I'm sure that there are people here, maybe many people, who have already given generously to the Haiti relief funds. So it's not, you know, a thing about everyone should be making a monetary donation. That's up to you. Only you can know what you can do or not do, what you can afford or not afford. That is another, for people who struggle with how much to give, that is another thing that can block one's generosity is fear. Just fear of, can I afford it? You know, it's a recession. I've got these bills piling up. Well, maybe you can't afford to give much at all, much at all. People who are unemployed, certainly it's understandable not to give anything or very much. But there's something about giving something. If not today, then after today or already before today. But to do something, to physically get your hands on a bill and embody it somehow, the giving, put some teeth behind the feeling, is very positive for ourselves. Never mind even just the Haitian people themselves, but our own merit, our own good karma to do something like that. I think there are people who are naturally more generous than others. I think this is a factor that is partly our conditioning, our parenting, what our parents did or didn't do. It might even have genetic correlates to it as to how willing we are to give money. But even those of us who tend to be more tight, more stinting in giving, we can overcome that to a degree by just working with it. Just give, all right, let's say, give $5. If I give $5, I can give another $5, I can give $10. What is that going to do to me? You know, so double it maybe. And what I find, because I'm one of those people who tends to hold on too tightly to money, I mean, as a lifelong thing, and I do see it in my parents. We're not stuck with a particular mode of anything. There is no self here that we're stuck with. We can exercise that muscle of generosity. We can find by doing that, the advantage of doing it little by little, over and over again, is we find that we're okay giving away more money than we thought we could, our initial response was. We're fine, certainly compared to the people of Haiti. So it's a practice. You can make it a practice like so many other things, a practice of giving. All right, our time is more than up, so we'll stop now and recite the four vows.